Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 260 of Her, the podcast, where you're going to hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her fears. Ooh. Yeah, you heard me right. This is going to be a terrific show. Before we begin, know that this episode is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And here's your reminder to click on iTunes after this episode to rate and review the show because we love listening to you. Your feedback is terrific. We read it all. You must know that. All right. It's time for her. What can I say? So I read this absolutely fabulous piece. It was an excerpt from a book called Nerve, Adventures in the Science of Fear. Now, you know I'm a physician and a scientist, and I'm all about learning new stuff like this. This fear thing was amazing because I'm a stress physiologist. And so I had to know more. And oh my gosh, what a terrific book written by Eva Holland. Eva is a correspondent for Outside Magazine. You all know that I'm a senior Olympic triathlete. I live in trees somewhere. The horror of life is to actually have to be indoors. And so the minute I know someone is a correspondent for Outside, I'm like high-fiving her in 2 seconds. And a former editor at Up Here, the magazine of Canada's Far North. Her work has appeared in Esquire, Wired, Bloomberg, Pacific Standard. I could go on. You get the point. Geographic News, National Geographic News. And she has been nominated for a Canadian National Magazine Award, anthologized in the best American science and nature writing, the best women's travel writing. She's a best person all the way around. What can I say? She lives in Canada's Yukon Territory. Hey, Eva, welcome to the Her podcast.
Hi, thank you for that wonderful welcome.
I know, I'm exhausted. Jesus, you know, I was just reading this whole thing. I'm like, you're a kick-ass writer. There's no question about it. I mean, once I got a copy of your book, I was like, oh, whoa. And what's the first thing I read was what happened to you when you were, you know, recounting in the very beginning a personal history of fear. And the joke is, for me, I have a height thing. You know, now I've done the Grand Canyon twice, rim to rim, all of that. I do have moments, though. What I learned, there was a key thing to do, and that is just never look over. Just that's it. Stick to the path, look straight ahead. And when you're up about, you know, 1,000 feet or so, just don't look down. Do not look down because that will all be bad. And then when you were talking about rappelling as you were coming down, all right, I remember the first time I did that at Joshua Tree. And I was shaking so hard holding onto that rope. And the joke with rappelling is it's over before you know it. I mean, you're just sort of bouncing off the, you know, it's like, wait a minute, what? And your little legs are, you know, your feet are bouncing off the side of the mountain thing or whatever you're rappelling down from, and it's over, but it's just, you're consumed by fear. It's an amazing thing. So what's it like to live in the clutches of paralyzing dread? Tell us about that.
It's a really physical experience, I think. You know, we tend to think of it as like an emotion, like a feeling, right? And it is a feeling, but it's also such a physical experience. You know, your limbs lock up and your chest tightens and your heart races. And, you know, if you looked in a mirror, you'd probably see that your pupils were dilated. It's a full body thing, which I think we don't always think about, you know?
Huh. And you know, since women per se, have a much higher incidence of anxiety. We call it the generalized anxiety disorder. And so women per se are not just worriers. I think we're pre-worriers. We worry about not worrying enough. And so we get all wound up, and then there's this fear factor. And many times that will grip us and paralyze us as we worry about things, as we are consumed by certain fears. It's sort of what we call the what-if syndrome. But what if that happens? What if this happens to my partner? What if? How do you, what's the science going on with that whole thing when you talk about the science of fear?
Right. So it's about threat perception, right? It's all of those what ifs are us trying to navigate potential threats to our safety, to our family, maybe to our financial well-being, to our community. And so we have this system that's built to respond to threats, but it can sort of go into overdrive, I guess, where it perceives threats where there aren't any, or where it perceives threats, you know, sooner than it needs to respond. You know, the system is built to respond to sort of clear and direct threats, and where we tend to get into trouble is with ambiguous threats or potential threats. So that's where all those what ifs that you can spiral down into, they all might be valid potential threats, but is asking what if in the moment helpful to navigating them? Not necessarily, but it's a very natural sort of cycle to fall into.
Yeah, it's very hard though sometimes, you know, when you start obsessing and you're just plain fearful. Think of all the things that make people fearful. Now, clearly, you know, being at the top of a mountain and having to rappel down, okay, you know, that's not a hard sell. You know, most people just grip to fear at the very thought. But, you know, speaking in front of a crowd, you know, when you're not that, you know, adept, and maybe you have fears like, what will they think? You know, I'm a fraud. I'll stumble over my words. My PowerPoint will explode in front of me. I don't know, whatever's going to happen. What's going on in someone when they allow this to start churning like a mental Cuisinart? Walk us through some of the science behind that.
So what scientists understand about the threat response or the fear response is that it starts with some kind of typically sensory trigger of some kind, usually external. Let's say you wake up in your apartment and you hear a noise in the night, and your nerves carry that information to your brain, where it is processed, and it's processed at the subconscious level initially. So all of this happens, you know, microscopically quickly, but initially it's not sort of your conscious mind that is processing this information. It's sort of in the basement, and the brain says, specifically an organ called the brain structure called the amygdala sort of does the sorting of this information, the sensory information that comes in, and says, is this a threat or not? And if it determines that it's a threat, that triggers the autonomic nervous system, which is what people sometimes call our fight or flight response, or people sometimes say now a fight, flight, or freeze response. And so that's what gets all those physical processes pumping away as your body prepares to react to a threat. And then your body again carries that information about those physical responses back to the brain, goes upstairs to the conscious mind, the self, and you say, oh, look at how my body is reacting. I'm afraid. Which is sort of counterintuitive at first to think that the reaction comes first and then the emotion follows the physical reaction. But when I really thought about it, it did make sense to me. Sometimes you can feel your body start to react before you even really know why, you know, that creepy feeling. And so, but what happens when we do these sort of anxiety spirals is that we can't calm that system down. And scientists are really still trying to understand why some people are better at others than others at breaking that cycle, at calming that spiral. And they're starting to understand the role that sort of applying the brakes to our fear response can play. Previously, they had looked mostly at the triggering function, and now they're sort of understanding that being able to tap the brakes is really important too.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, people need to understand that this fight and flight and freeze response is a really integral survival mechanism. It's one of the most powerful survival tools in our little tool chest, so that appropriately so, we should, you know, take flight or fight. And sometimes even freeze is perfectly fine. You see a very large bear. Hey, you're up there in the Yukon, right? So you see a very large bear. Let's not run. Let's try to think of things a little bit, you know, differently. Maybe there are some, you know, tricks and tools and things you can use. But it's all about survival. It's about survival. The problem is that when people are gripped for fear, with fear chronically, and they keep that thing going. And this was never meant to be going on a long-term basis. This was meant to be I'm going to help you survive. Let's move on after this. But many people just hold on to that. Talk to us about chronic fear. It's just always there.
Right. I'm so glad you brought up a bear, because that's sort of my favorite analogy for the levels of, you know, fear and anxiety that we can go through. Is, you know, a very reasonable fear response is, you see a bear in your campsite. That's sort of pure fear response, right? And then the next level is maybe lying awake at night in your tent in that campsite, thinking about if a bear might come. That's anxiety, but it might be a reasonable anxiety. And then the next level is lying awake at night in your tent, thinking about whether there might be a bear in your campsite, and you're not even in bear country. That's when you're starting to kind of get into this chronic worry, chronic anxiety, different, you know, people sometimes say catastrophizing, different terms that we get into to describe this mental state. And it's really hard on our systems to be sort of in that elevated response mode. It's hard for our bodies to sustain that emergency response, and it's damaging. So it's important to find ways to calm that system down.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You brought back a wild and crazy memory. And that is, I went to the Banff Forest. Canada is one of my most favorite places in the world. And I was up with a buddy, a hiking buddy, who, what is the name of that huge hotel there where the beautiful lake is?
Oh, the Banff Springs.
Oh yeah. So, you know, we were hiking off trail. So we were off trail. And next thing I know, we were doing really crazy ass things. Like I was fording like some very interesting little riverish looking things and crawling up rocks. Of course, no ropes or anything. What was I thinking? And next thing I know, we were at a pretty good height. And then I was basically on a very slender path. And it was a small path, and with literally a 1,000-foot drop. And I said, how in God's name did I end up here? This is insane. So then I asked a real simple question. Our guide was this just bear of a man. You know, he's one of these guys. He could probably, you know, crawl up 1,000 feet and, you know, no ropes, nothing. He's just sort of a wild person. And I said, hey, how are we? Are we returning? He goes, oh, yes, we're definitely returning. I said, oh, that's great. When are we, you know, like going to start descending? He says, well, when we cross across the ravine. I said, wait a minute, let's do that again. Cross what? And he said, yeah, if you look ahead, and I swear as I sit here, Eva, seriously, there, somewhere along the line, I don't know when, a gigantic kind of boulderish thing fell across the ravine, you know, and this 1,000-foot drop, and where you could hear the crashing of the water down below. And he said, yeah, we just go across that. I said, wait a minute, you go across a boulder over 1,000 feet. Okay, now that was it. All my sphincters were tight. And I said, wait a minute now, let's think about this. And so, of course, what does he do? He just literally stands up on the boulder. I'm about ready to throw up. He walks across the damn boulder. And at any point, he could have slipped. But, you know, he made it on the other side. And he goes, see? And I said, that's it. I'm going to die. This is it. This is how I did it, Eva. And you could have probably guessed it. On my belly. Okay.
Of course.
Are you kidding? I was like me, the little frog. I was on my belly. And every single second I moved, all right, seriously, you know, when you cry and you don't know you're crying, it's just stuff's happening in your eyes because you're in such a level of fear that you don't even know. It's like you when you were rappelling. I made it to the other side, and that was the one time in my life I literally, I was at a point of fear. I don't know that I could possibly have felt. That's why when I read your thing and I knew you were from, you know, Canada, I said, oh man, does that bring back a little memory or two? Oh man, you're killing me here.
Memories of terror in Canada. Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot. You know, and by the way, oh my God, any excuse to get to Canada, you seriously, one of my all-time favorite, you know, neighbors and countries to go visit. So can you talk about the fear cure? This is a fabulous part of your book that I love. Give us a teaser on the fear cure. What is that really all about?
Sure. So I have had, like you, an enduring fear of heights, and specifically of sort of exposed heights. I'm okay on bridges and in elevators and in airplanes. It's when I feel like I can fall. So that sense of exposure of dangling or being on a steep slope. And eventually, after, you know, various embarrassing incidents and meltdowns and crawling on my belly at various times, I decided to go to Amsterdam and undergo this experimental drug treatment for phobias. And it sounds too good to be true. It sounds very sci-fi. It is a single pill that you take one time in combination with the therapist triggering your fear as just about as strongly as she can. She said she had to get me to like 80 or 90% of my max. I think they got me to maybe 75, 80. And so they terrify you, and then they give you this pill, and it's the treatment is built around recent neuroscientific research to do with memory formation and storage. And the pill is a common beta blocker. People take it for stage fright, for blood pressure. It's called propranolol. And in isolation, it wouldn't cure phobia, but it's in combination with this triggering because of what we know about how memories are stored and that beta blockers interrupt this protein synthesis process in our minds that deals with long-term memory storage. And so the combination of scaring the crap out of you and then giving you the pill seems to sort of sever the connection between your previous panics, your phobic attacks, and your future ones. And so it's like it slices off that connection that drags you back down that same, you know, train of thought you've been down so many times before. And in future, you don't panic again. It sounds very sci-fi, but I went to Amsterdam and I tried it out.
Well, you know, it's not sci-fi, really. Here in the U.S. of A., Inderol is actually the brand name, but propranolol is used by a lot of celebrities who have stage fright. You know, here they are really talented individuals, but then all of a sudden, you know, there's like, you know, 15,000 people in a crowd and they're all like clapping for you. You just are having an issue. You're having a moment and things aren't going so swimmingly because you're going into the fear place. All the what ifs start churning in your brain. And what if I'm stupid? What if I, you know, my music doesn't come out right? What if my voice cracks? Blah, blah, blah. You know, it just keeps going on and on. And actually, go into the science of propranolol. Explain to people how this thing works in you. Yeah, go for it.
Right. So if you took it to calm your stage fright, for instance, it would just sort of spread a calming effect through your body in the short term, but it wouldn't sort of permanently alter you the way this treatment theoretically does. But so a few years ago, a neuroscientist at NYU, he's actually back in Canada now, he did some research on rats, I believe, that suggested that he could disrupt their fear conditionings. Fear conditioning is, you know, classic psychology. He found that he could disrupt their fear conditioning by giving them a beta blocker, but only if their fear was triggered as well. So if he didn't trigger their fear conditioning with let's say the musical tone, whatever the case might be that they had been conditioned to fear, if he didn't trigger them before giving them the beta blocker, their conditioning was unchanged. But if he triggered them and then gave them the beta blocker, then the conditioning would be unraveled. And that is the science that this Dr. Merrill Kent in Amsterdam built on. The idea being that we knew that when you first form long-term memories, when you sort of put new memories in storage, there's a protein synthesis reaction in your brain. And I am afraid I do not have the scientific skills to describe how protein synthesis works in great detail, but essentially this was sort of a part of the memory storage process. And what this new work discovered is that protein synthesis is also involved when we call up these memories from storage and put them away again. And that disrupting them during that calling up and restoring, they call it reconsolidation. When you disrupt the protein synthesis in reconsolidation of long-term memories, it has these larger effects. And so that is what this treatment in Amsterdam is based on, is disrupting. So when Dr. Kent triggers my fear of heights, that calls up all my previous memories of all the times I've flipped out and panicked and cried and, you know, begged for mercy in the past. And then the propranolol, the drug, does its work. And not only did I immediately become calm, but also, you know, beyond my ability to sense what was happening, this memory storage process was disrupted. And the next time I was exposed to heights, yeah. And it is something about changing our relationship to those memories changes future reactions, which is fascinating when you think about how much our fear reaction is shaped by what we've been taught to fear.
Huh. Well, which brings us to another interesting point, and that is, how do you perceive the word fearless? What does it mean? I mean, we're sitting here talking about fear and, you know, funky fears and fears that like really grip us. And then someone says, and she's quite fearless. What does that mean? Is that even normal?
Yeah, well, I will say I perceive the word differently now than I did when I started working on this book. You know, before I started working on the book, I think I would have said fearlessness was like bravery, like courage. And it's something to aspire to and something to cultivate in yourself. You know, it's great to be fearless. And within reason, you know, I think we view it as a quality for good reason. But it turns out that being truly fearless is really dangerous and really, really hard. Because as you said, fear is a survival mechanism. And if it's stripped out of you, the ability to feel fear, then you're left without your main defense.
Yeah, there's no question about it. You know, there are medical conditions where people have very, very little fear. And so they don't fear the police. So they go out and they gun down a play yard. They, you know, it's really weird. And so it can go in a lot of different directions. You have people who have extraordinarily high thresholds for managing fear. And so these are the people who bungee jump off, you know, some ridiculously high bridge, and they think it's very funny. And you're throwing up on the bridge. There's no way in God's green earth I'm ever doing that to myself. But they think it's funny. And these are, but I think that, you know, people are born with different thresholds for the perception of fear. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a spectrum. There's, you know, the people that scientists call high sensation seekers who, you know, how fear is kind of, you know, fear can kind of be right on the line between being unpleasant and being a thrill, you know, like a roller coaster, for instance, or a scary movie, people seek that out. And so these high sensation seekers are people who lean more towards the thrilling aspect of fear, I think. And so they seek out these strenuous and potentially terrifying experiences. So they're at the far end of the spectrum from someone like me who's more risk averse and cautious and thinking about consequences. And then, like you said, yeah, there are a small number of people who are truly sort of medically fearless. And as it turns out, their lives are really hard and scary. I wrote about a woman who's known to scientists as Patient SM, who I was really touched by her story. You know, she has been taken advantage of because she's not suspicious of people. She sometimes forgets to eat. She has trouble keeping friends because, not because she's unkind, because she's too kind. She comes on too strong, because think of the the extent to which we're governed by a fear of rejection, maybe in building relationships. And she doesn't have that. She's got no handrails whatsoever. And so she has this kind of hard, lonely life. And I'd never, it really, learning about her really made me think differently about fear. And even though my fear frustrates and embarrasses me more often than I would like, it really made me value my fear to learn about her situation.
Huh. And here's a final question. Is there a better way to feel afraid?
I think there is. Yeah. I think instead of, so often we talk in kind of a binary of like, you know, reject your fear, defeat your fear, you know, turn your back on your fear, confront your fear. It's all about sort of conquest. And I think the better way to be afraid is to understand that fear matters and to find a way to learn when to embrace your fear and when to shut it down, because we shouldn't always listen. We know that, but sometimes we should. And so it's about figuring out that middle path of sort of a healthy relationship with our fear.
Interesting. Interesting. And learning how to do this. I think you summarize this beautifully at the end of your book. I know now that I don't need to make my world smaller. I don't have to allow fear to shrink the boundaries of the life that I live. But I also know that I don't have to keep trying, pushing, proving myself. I don't have to become a rock climber if I don't enjoy rock climbing, even if it doesn't scare me as much as it used to. I can choose to seek thrills, to embrace the rush of fear, or I can choose to stay home and read a good book. Maybe I'll go back to Florence someday. Maybe I'll try to learn to sail again. But if I don't, I'll know that it's not because fear stopped me. If I never make it back to the top of the Duomo, it'll be because there was so much else to do and see in the world. My time is not limitless. Something I can now accept, mostly without fear. Beautifully written. I mean, really, Eva, that just
well,
rocks
you so
it.
Much.
No, for real. And so I just think you did that beautifully. And I think you've also been so human about describing your own experience and what kind of, you know, push you and fueled you, you know, to write this fabulous book. Everyone out there in the Her Podcast land, you know, we've been talking to Eva Holland, and she is the author of just an outstanding book. It's called Nerve, Adventures in the Science of Fear. Her website is Eva Holland, and that's HOLLAND.com. And, you know, when we're all, you know, up there in Canada, USA, all through this world, we're kind of gripped in many respects with the fear of the COVID pandemic, this viral pandemic that's pretty much ground a lot of our life and livelihoods to a halt. Maybe it's time to use this as an opportunity to just hit the pause button and to examine that fear, and then to see how we can survive in a way that's much more calm, thinking it through, facing the fears, putting them on the table, and really confronting them, and maybe coming up with a better strategy, very much the way that Eva did in her book, where she is in better control now of those choices that she makes. You have a choice to look at the fears involved with a brand new world, a new normal, as the mass majority of the world is now looking at reopening their economies and our personal lives. Wow, what an opportunity. And what a great book to help us basically understand what our options are as we face these fears. So Eva, thank you again so much for being on the Her Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Excellent. And everyone out there, this has been a fabulous, absolutely fabulous show. So please take a minute to hit iTunes, rate and review it. We want to hear your feedback, your fearful feedback. Maybe not so much. We'll know. And listen, I want to hear from you because hearing what you have to say about these very important topics that we discuss on the Her podcast means everything to us because it helps us understand you and what your needs are. Why am I so interested? Well, because I'm Dr. Pam Peek. I'm host of the Her podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every single episode of the Her podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today. Stay safe and stay well.